there's a lot of signals and things that the propensity model looks at, and there are, you know, other models in market that we've seen, like you mentioned propensity to churn, for example, but those are just sort of like, usually it's just like a general propensity for someone to churn, whereas our model actually can predict on a very granular level down to like the individual SKU, which is super interesting. Welcome to the State of CRM podcast. I'm Matt Engstrom, and today we have a special edition of the podcast. I'm actually in Paris at the Tiny Clues headquarters, as you can see, talking to Simone Boissineau, who is the Technical Operations Director at Tiny Clues. Simone and his team are the brains behind the propensity modeling that powers a lot of the Tiny Clues engine and basically brings value to CRM marketers, and that's a lot of what we've been talking about in previous episodes of the podcast: identifying demand, being able to build audiences, target effectively, all of the things that we talk about from sort of like a creating relevancy experience for customers. And we've had tons of content on that in the past, but today we're going to talk a little bit more around propensity modeling in general, and take a little bit of a different angle and just talk about what it is and some of the different applications of it, because we've been focusing a lot specifically on how it drives CRM marketing strategy and how it can effectively essentially drive revenue and create relevant experiences. So Simone, I think let's just kick it off by chatting a little bit about yourself and learning more about kind of your background and kind of what brought you to Tiny Clues in terms of your experience.
Sure. So I started my career as a PhD researcher, actually, in nuclear physics. So it can look pretty far from marketing and this kind of stuff, but the common underlying stuff are the analysis of data, basically, a large amount of data. I joined Tiny Clues in 2014 after meeting David. At that time, we were something like 8 or 9 people. It was pretty early startup, and it was a perfect context for me to switch from academic to professional context, because small teams, you can explore a lot of different subjects. You're in charge of a lot of things, maybe too much, but it's really the good way, I think, to learn fast and fail fast also. But it's really been a pretty exciting period for me when I joined the team. I started as a data scientist, but now I'm more focused on the technical operations, as you said, meaning that I'm focusing on strategic projects, just being sure that we deliver them on time and with the good quality as we expect during the design and this kind of stuff. So this is basically what I'm doing for Tiny Clues today.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And it's interesting to hear how you made sort of a progression from academics into business. I think there's a few folks actually in the business that have kind of followed a similar path.
I'm not the only one.
Yeah. Which is great, because I mean, this, we're talking about fairly complicated stuff, and it's great to have brains behind that, obviously. So you're obviously not just a team of one. Could you talk a little bit sort of around, you know, the technical operations team here in general at Tiny Clues?
In fact, we started the team at the beginning of a big migration for us that represented a huge challenge, and we are 4 people today working it. The common skill they have is that they spend several years at Tiny Clues, because you do need to understand very well the technical concepts, the way we need to use our stack, our way to predict stuff for our clients. So this is really people that are able to manage both technical and business challenges at the same time. This is something really hard to do, to be honest. And yes, you need several years to be familiar with all the need you need to know to achieve the mission we have as a technical operation team members. So most of them are engineers as initial formation, but they are really continuously switching from really deep technical stuff to A/B test, business challenges, new case exploratory projects and this kind of stuff. It's really exciting to be a bridge, I mean, between techniques and actual business needs.
Yeah, and that's interesting, because a lot of what we've been talking about on the podcast is more sort of around marketing strategy specifically, and and basically new ways for marketers to be able to think about scaling their campaigns to create relevant, personalized experiences. So I think a lot of the content and conversations we've had in the past have been very much on the business side. But as you mentioned, what's interesting today is we're kind of like talking to you as like a conduit between that, the technical piece, and translating it into business. Because I think if we're not solving specific client needs and we're not applying the technology in ways that actually solve real challenges for marketers, obviously, you know, there's the product isn't useful. So I think that's a really interesting role you're in. So let's dive a little bit more into the modeling itself. So again, for people that are maybe just dialing into this episode, maybe this is the first one, we have a lot of content where we talk about basically the way that you can sort of predict demand or identify those who might buy specific offers, which allows marketers to be able to build audiences, target more effectively in ways that are scalable. And some of the technology that we see in market isn't as scalable. And the thing that powers that or enables marketers to be able to sort of tap into that is really propensity modeling. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about kind of what that is?
Yeah, sure. So maybe we can start with a kind of generic definition for it.
Great.
It basically estimates the probability of performing actions. So it could be a lot of different actions. What do we mean by probability? So there's a lot of questions there, and there's also a lot of way of doing propensity modeling. You can do some pretty simple yet effective stuff in order to predict something that is not that hard to predict in your business, whatever it is. And what we do at TechNicluse is that we are using the most advanced deep learning stuff you can use, basically, to build those. And I think we will have the opportunity to discuss why it's unique, etc. But in the end, ultimately, we are still computing a probability to buy something, a specific offer. And yeah, this is what propensity modeling do. There is also other example in the industry, like churn probabilities, unsubscribe probabilities, etc. We are really focused on, I would say, positive action for now. Not to say that we won't never do any other propensity, kind of propensity model, but for now, yeah, we are based on data history, at least months and preferably years of data history, we are trying to predict the coming behavior for the whole client's user database.
Yeah, and I think what's so fascinating to me about that and kind of what drew me into TinyClues is the idea that, like, you know, I always have made assumptions that, like, people are not that predictable, right? Human behavior can be sort of erratic, and buying behavior too. Like, people, you know, can buy things based on a whim or emotions or something like that. So the idea that you can look at data and then make a future prediction about whether or not somebody is going to make a buying decision is really interesting to me. And I think, like, you know, traditionally there's been a heavy reliance on things like, well, you know, this is a swimsuit for women, so only women are going to buy this swimsuit. But I think what we find is in a lot of cases that's a very narrow and inaccurate way to be targeting and to be looking at ways to market. So I think it might be interesting to talk a little bit about, I know that there's a lot of signals and things that the propensity model looks at, and there are, you know, other models in market that we've seen, like you mentioned propensity to churn, for example. But those are just sort of like, usually it's just like a general propensity for someone to turn. Whereas our model actually can predict very on a very granular level down to like the individual SKU, which is super interesting.
Yeah.
How is that even possible?
And as you mentioned, I think it's something really unique because we keep all the details we have regarding the past behavior for all the user database all along the algorithm, meaning we will never lost any detail in the learning phase. In most of the other industries' attempts to build propensity modeling, they all start the feature engineering part, meaning that you will start leveraging your data, clean them, etc. They will start by building some aggregates, basically. They will simplify the data. And even worse, they can add some a priori stuff about their data, meaning that you will not only aggregate and simplify them, you will think like you already know the answer and you won't let the data give you the answer to the business problem. So the idea for us is to, as I said, keep the finest detail we can have from the behavioral history, and do not use any a priori stuff. So feature engineering at TinyClubs is something really advanced, really serious, and we are challenging it in a scientific way every single week for all our clients, meaning that we are we do have hyperparameter tuning stuff. It's a big word, but the idea is just that the algorithm will be re-challenged on a weekly basis, which is something really hard to do, especially when you are using really advanced deep learning stuff. And we are using on a weekly basis just to be sure that we won't keep a bias or an a priori all along the life cycle of our clients. We need to change it every single week using the data update they sent us. It's something really important. We do need to have fresh data, as fresh as possible. So a daily basis is what we recommend our clients to do. But still, again, what makes us unique, I think, is the way we keep all the details and we do not use any a priori or manual cleaning of stuff. We just put all the data we have in the algorithm and they are selected in the most impartial scientific way we can achieve. And this is something we are continuously improving in our stack.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think like the primary, you know, the primary end users of our modeling have generally been CRM marketers.
Yeah.
And to your point, using the data in an up-to-date, accurate way to predict demand in the moment, because demand is shifting over time. And one thing that you know was really interesting to me in learning more about sort of how TinyClubs works is that the algorithm itself can actually select the signals that are, or identify signals that are more, I guess, more significant in terms of prediction. So not all signals are created equal, which I think, like, kind of going back to the previous point around, you know, basic segmentation and things like that, there's an assumption that these are inherently significant in being able to predict intent, but we know that humans can't actually really make that call. You have to be able to use complex mathematics and algorithms to be able to do that. How is the algorithm able to actually prioritize signals? Like, how does it identify what's significant and what's not?
Well, it's a good question, because when it goes to deep learning, there's at some point, it could be frightening, but at some point this is a black box, meaning that the price to pay for taking the opportunity to leverage the complexity of your data means that you will build a really deep and complex understanding in a mathematical way of the data sets, and you won't be able to understand all the interactions that has been identified by the algorithm. What you can do is challenge the output of your algorithm, meaning if I ask you to build a propensity to buy this offer or this offer and you do it at scale, you will start to learn how your model is good or not first, and how it's able to do some advanced stuff from a business perspective. For example, for travel, it could be pretty difficult to predict something that is rare. The frequency is pretty low. You are not taking vacation every week, sadly, but still you are.
You can.
Yeah, exactly. So it's always a good surprise for me to see how we are able to extract complicated nonlinear interaction from the data. But at some point, you just have to give up about the way we are extracting interaction. This is the price to pay, because we don't want to use a priori. So it means that in some way, you won't have the full control of this, but you have the full control of the output, and you can see, challenge, and present to your client actually the ability of our algorithm to catch the important behavior from their data, and the ability to product performances in the future. And we'll go back to performances, I think, in a few minutes. But yeah, the easy answer is it's complicated, because it's deep learning, basically. At some point, this is a black box.
Yeah.
But we better need to assume this and to see how we can challenge it as an output. Talking about the scores, talking about the overlaps, I can explain this in more details if needed, but yeah, just let the algorithm do the job, and we will judge the output, we will assess the quality afterwards.
Yeah, that makes sense. And again, I think, like, you know, the application for marketers is pretty clear. And something that's pretty interesting to me is recently we've been talking a lot about what's called cold start. And I think, like, that's something I'd actually like to cover, just because I think it's super interesting, especially for marketers looking to launch new products or potentially drive demand for products that they don't have significant transaction history for. So my understanding of it is basically it uses attributes of other products
exactly.
to basically predict demand for another existing product,
yeah.
which I think is really interesting, because a lot of lookalike modeling needs to rely on a certain amount of transaction history for that specific product. But the algorithm itself is able to go beyond that and use similar attributes of other products to predict demand. Am I getting that right?
That's exactly it. And you can't achieve this without using really advanced deep learning models that will be able to understand the interaction between properties. Because if you don't have a lot of samples at the beginning, you will need to leverage the samples you do have for other offers and understand how they interact with the properties you do have for the cold start product. Yeah. But it's something crazy.
Yeah.
For me, pretty good understanding of the mechanism, it's something crazy, because ultimately, even if you do never sell it, you will be able to build a propensity score. Doesn't mean that you don't need to challenge it from a business perspective,
yeah.
for sure, when you test it, but you're able to compute a score.
Yeah.
This is crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. And actually, what's interesting hearing you say that is I found it's very, very difficult from a mathematical perspective to impress a data scientist. So I think seeing that, that you're excited about that means it's probably something pretty cool, which I think is a pretty good segue into talking more about, like, sort of propensity modeling as it relates, you know, to data scientists themselves. So, like, primarily the RM users have been marketers, but we also talk a lot with data science teams. And what we're seeing is in market, there's kind of a brands, especially with the resources and the teams to be able to do so, are sort of moving in this direction of potentially building some of these things in-house to actually build propensity prediction in-house. And I think, like, you know, maybe it makes sense for business, maybe not, but, you know, considering that TinyClues is kind of offering this as a service, or if you're a marketer through our platform, you know, is there potentially a benefit for data scientists themselves to sort of access modeling from a third party like TinyClues?
Yeah, I think so. To be honest, I think this is definitely something we will explore with some existing clients as a start in the coming weeks or months, because in most of our projects, when you focus too much on the technical challenge of building your own propensity score, etc., you will completely forget at some point that you need to address some business challenges, some business question. So you will spend months, not to say years, just trying to build your stack, basically, because you're excited, you're a geek, you want to have your pipelines, you know, running all day without any errors and this kind of stuff. But it will take at least six months, I would say, to build something like this, or even more for most of the cases we have seen so far with our clients or prospects. And in the end, you don't really challenge yourself about what is the question I want to address.
Yeah.
So you will end with a functional, I would say, from a technical standpoint, pipeline, but with almost no ability to answer your teams internally. It could be marketing, could be purchase team, offers, logistics. I don't know. There's a lot of different problematics to be addressed. And from my experience, most of those guys that arrive as a head of data science, new department in companies, retailers or not, that are not focused on technology at the beginning, just end 2 or 3 years after starting the project with a functional pipeline, but with no ability, again, to predict anything useful for the company. So the ultimately the most interesting stuff they have in some cases a clean data warehouse, because this is the fuel for the algorithm. So at least they've cleaned all the assets of the company, and still this is something interesting, but this is the beginning, to be honest. And I think we could have the opportunity to make them only focus on the business part, because you can start with the propensity score from Tiny Clues, and just with this starting point of having a lot of scores available, what should I do with them? This is the hardest question to answer, is this one, actually. It's not really the technical one, because you will be able to continuously improve your algorithm, your pipeline, your stuff. This is an infinite work, but you need to first choose the question you need to address. And I think this is an opportunity for them to focus on, but it's the biggest challenge for me.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, one thing that I found kind of just chatting with teams in the field too that are looking to kind of build models on their own, like, it's one thing to potentially build a model for one product to send out, like, to target a campaign, like one campaign in a week, for example.
Yeah.
But like when you're talking about like applying it to larger business challenges, like for example, commerce, and specifically looking at opportunities to make product recommendations for individuals visiting a website, like that has to be up to date. It has to be accurate for every single offer that you have. Like you can't just build a model for one and use that to your point around
feature engineering.
Yeah,
exactly.
To your point around actually addressing real business challenges, it to be able to do that effectively, like it becomes a lot more difficult. And you know, we've seen teams effectively create, again, like one model for one product to target a campaign in one specific week. But if you want to scale that and make that applicable to other business use cases, such as product recommendations on your website, then it becomes a lot more difficult.
Yeah.
And the investment becomes bigger. You need a bigger team, you need more resources, and it generally is a pretty long runway. I think, you know, we're talking to a client now who is trying to do it for several years, and I think is coming to terms with the fact that it might be a bit more than they could chew in terms of like what their current team is.
Exactly. And I think marketers are continuously facing a lot of changes in their calendar. I mean, on a daily basis. Oh, I need to add a specific campaign or a specific action on display or something. It's really difficult to adapt when you are dealing with a technical stack. It's really difficult to not being able to predict or to schedule stuff in a really regular manner. You know. So, yeah, this is one of the biggest challenges we have addressed for the CRM part up to now with our platform. In addition to the algorithm part, obviously.
Yeah. You know, which is, and I think, like, you know, a lot of our audience today is probably coming at this more from the business than the data science perspective. So I think it could be interesting maybe to explore some of the other business use cases. So we talked about, you know, potentially product recommendations from a commerce perspective on a website. We also have something called that is in market as well. Like we've seen it from other companies, but you know, obviously our algorithm is very well set up to deliver this, something called Next Best Offer. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, kind of what that means and maybe what some of the applications are for that?
Yeah, so we've already achieved a lot of exploratory project on this, to be honest. I know what I'm talking about, but yeah, this is an important point there is that our core value, which is the deep learning algorithm, could be used for a lot more use cases that we did until now about CRM. So this is a good news for not only for us but also for our clients. And the idea with the Next Best Offer is just to help them to find the best offer to be promoted for a given user. So it's kind of a recommendation stuff, I would say. The idea is just to say, let me select maybe 20, 30, 50 offers in my catalog that I have good reason to think that this is the best one I can promote for now. And are you able to associate 1, 2, 3, or 5 of those offers to every single user in my database to allow me to leverage all possible channel I have in my hand yeah, to promote them.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting because like when we talk about sort of like building segments or identifying demand for a specific offer, like a red shoe, for example, you're sort of starting with the product and then kind of identifying the market demand for that offer so that you can reach the right people, which makes sense in a lot of business use cases if you need to promote something specific. However, like what kind of like what you're talking about is more sort of like customizing the like delivery for an individual consumer potentially.
Exactly.
And it has implications for you're sending out a newsletter, you need sort of like dynamic content to be populated with it, like
could
something
be,
like this.
Could be the landing page of your website.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. I mean, there's so many interesting use cases and you know, the industry is so focused on personalization. If you can't do this right, I think you're missing like a huge fundamental step in creating a relevant experience for your customer. Like this to me is like the thing that you would need to get right to be able to do that well.
And it will give you the opportunity to be really consistent across the different channels and the different way you have to communicate with your clients. So this is something also important.
Yeah, yeah.
By using the same scores, I would say, or the same fuel at the beginning.
Yeah, really interesting. I think, you know, last topic I wanted to talk about, cause it's something that's a little bit interesting to me. So I have a bit of a background sort of in on the media side of marketing. You know, and we talk a lot about CRM and sort of the applications of propensity modeling for CRM marketers, and obviously been talking a bit about that today. But I think there's a big opportunity potentially, you know, for acquisition and media optimization as well. So we're talking about potentially the use of something like this to be able to target potential customers programmatically or on social platforms like Facebook, for example. And something that you know we've talked a bit about is sort of like seeding these segments to be able to create more relevant advertising. Because like I mean, like a lot of the programmatic engines sort of optimize towards whether or not somebody will interact with an ad. But that's still a high funnel metric. Like interaction doesn't necessarily tell you much about whether or not that person's actually going to convert through that ad. So, you know, I think there's a big opportunity for ads to be optimized towards lower funnel conversion-based metrics, potentially using some of this modeling. Is that something that you're currently thinking about, or?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Actually, we did some again exploratory projects with smart seeding. This is a way we can define this. So smart seeding, it was still more for loyalty and CRM problematics at that time. But this is the same mechanism for media and acquisition, I would say. The idea is just to build an audience that is big enough to be used as a useful seeding in the social platform, as you said. And one important point, and I think it's a big asset for us, is that we do not have any limitation in terms of volumes.
Okay.
Theoretically, we are basically scoring the whole user database. So it's up to you, and we provide you with some metrics to take your decision, obviously. But if you want to take 200,000 people for your smart seeding, it's okay. You don't need to have 200,000 people that both are demonstrate direct interest into something. This is where our capacity to catch implicit intention is really important. So the fact that there is no limitation on this, and you are still using deep learning algorithms that are smart in the end, will give our clients, I think, the opportunity to use smart seeding for more and more use cases in the future.
That's interesting. And I think, you know, obviously there's sort of this pending theoretical apocalypse around the deprecation of third-party data, and you know, we're kind of running up against some pretty potential big deadlines in terms of the not being able to use cookies for targeting anymore. And I think one, this is potentially better and more effective than that is. So you know, like kind of like looking for like companies and brands and players in the media space are looking for alternatives to cookie-based targeting, but you know, I think there's maybe a different way to look at it where your first-party data, which is generally fairly protected against regulation that has to do with like the actual tech companies themselves self-regulating and deprecating cookies. Like, that's data that companies already own, and that's what's feeding this engine and allowing for marketers to be able to do this. So not only is it more effective, but it's also future-proofed as well. So I think, like, it's a really interesting thought, and probably a trend that's gonna blow up in the next few months or years as marketers start to realize that there's better and also like ways of targeting that have longevity. So I think that's super interesting.
Yeah, and we are ready to explore it. So
good. Yeah. I know you guys are excited about it. I think we could go on for probably hours on this, but I think it's probably time to wrap up. But I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, no problem. This was great. I think we'll definitely have to have you back. I hope everybody enjoyed it. Obviously, a little bit of a different type of content today. In the next few weeks, Ben and I will be back to kind of doing our old thing once I get back to New York. But thank you for tuning into the State of CRM podcast. And if you have any questions about anything that we talked about today, let us know. Happy to answer on social. You know where to ping us. But thank you very much for listening, and we will catch you next week. Thank you, Simon.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.